From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Michael C. Hall. He plays the inhibited gay brother on HBO's 6 Feet Under. He's currently starring in the Broadway revival of Chicago. Also, the actor with one of the most distinctive voices around, James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader and Verizon. A new edition of his memoir has just been published. The word greed is getting a lot of play these days. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on its use. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the foreign film Mostly Marta. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An American Muslim held in the government's terrorism investigation has asked a judge to release him since the government has filed no charges against him. The lawyer for James Ujamaa pleaded his case today in Alexandria, Virginia, where Ujamaa has been held for a month. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Ujamaa was arrested in Denver, then transferred to the same jurisdiction where the government is trying Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker. Officials suspect Ujamaa of selling computers to the Taliban. He's also believed to have been friendly with two imams suspected of recruiting al-Qaeda members. A decade ago, Ujamaa was hailed in Seattle as a community activist who steered young men away from drugs and gangs. Friends and family say he's being unfairly targeted because he converted to Islam. The Justice Department is holding Ujamaa as a material witness, meaning they can detain him indefinitely. But Ujamaa's lawyer says this would violate his constitutional rights. A federal judge is expected to rule within 60 days. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
An Egyptian man pleaded not guilty today to charges that he made and sold fake identification in New Jersey. FBI officials have said Mohammed El Atris provided phony IDs to two of the September 11th hijackers. Atris was arrested earlier this week after returning from Egypt, where he'd been when New Jersey officials raided his home and offices. An attorney for Atris said his client is innocent and has been cooperating with authorities in Egypt and the United States. Prosecutors said Atris created and sold hundreds of fake documents, including driver's licenses and other ID cards. At a time when many of the major U.S. airlines are losing money, number 3 Delta Airlines now says it plans to embark on an alliance with the number 4 and 5 U.S. carriers. The agreement with Northwest and Continental comes on the heels of a similar arrangement involving United and U.S. Airways. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Code-sharing arrangements where the airlines honor one another's frequent flyer miles, connect routes, and coordinate check-ins aren't new. However, their role has expanded lately as the industry seeks to recover from September 11th and the weaker economy. But not everyone is pleased with the agreements. Ed Faberman with the Air Carriers Association, the group representing smaller airlines, says the alliances often lead to decreased competition and don't necessarily result in lower fares.
Every now and then, one of them might drop a fare or might have a weekend special, but there's very, very little fare competition going on.
The latest alliance allows Delta to connect its strong route network in the southern U.S. with Continental and Northwest routes in the east and Midwest. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 180 points or 2% to close at 8,872. The Nasdaq lost 42 points to close at 1,380. This is NPR News. A jury in Cicero, Illinois, has convicted the town president and 6 co-defendants of conspiracy in a scheme to steal $12 million from the town coffers. Prosecutors said Cicero president Betty Lauren Maltese and the 6 others used a fake insurance company to siphon payments from the town. Among those convicted was Michael Spano Sr., said by prosecutors to be the leaders of organized crime in the city, which is on the outskirts of Chicago. The government of Argentina says it doesn't have enough money to pay state workers their salaries, despite a Supreme Court ruling ordering the government to back off from a pay cut. Scott Goldberg has more from Buenos Aires.
Argentina's cabinet chief, Alfredo Atanasoff, says there's simply not enough cash in the treasury to comply with the Supreme Court's ruling. But he said the government is forced to respect it. Argentina's high court struck down a controversial pay cut enacted last December, which slashed state workers' salaries by 13%. Atanasoff says the pay cuts would have saved the government $2.25 billion, a hefty sum in a country on the verge of financial collapse. Argentina is waiting to hear if the International Monetary Fund will send an emergency loan, but the IMF has told the government it must cut spending first, something that will be more complicated after the Supreme Court decision. For NPR News, I'm Scott Goldberg in Buenos Aires.
Police in Florida have arrested a man they say was planning to attack an Islamic education center and some mosques. At a hearing in federal court in Tampa today, prosecutors charged Robert Goldstein with possession of explosives. Prosecutors said the 37-year-old podiatrist had homemade bombs and a list of Islamic sites. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership, celebrating its 10th anniversary and proudly sponsoring Fast Track for starting and growing businesses.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Michael C. Hall is one of the stars of 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about a family which owns a funeral parlor. Hall is well known on the New York stage and is currently starring in the Broadway revival of the musical Chicago. Terry spoke with him in March. 6 Feet Under begins taping its third season this fall. Last year it won 2 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Drama Series. The father, who ran the business, died in the first episode. The 2 sons, Nate and David, took it over. David, played by Michael C. Hall, is more straight-laced, business-oriented, and uptight than his brother. He's also gay and came out to his family during the first season of the show. In the first episode of the second season, his mother was trying to be supportive of him. At the same time, she wanted to let her children know that she's having a relationship with Nikolai, the owner of the flower shop where she works. In this scene, she's telling the family that she's invited Nikolai to a family dinner. She wants each of her children to bring someone, too.
Nate, I'd like you to invite Brenda. Claire, I'd like you to invite Gabriel Dimas. And David, if you have a special friend, I'd like for him to come as well.
Why is my friend special?
All right. If you're having sex with anyone, I'd like to meet him. Is that better?
Not really.
Stop acting like children! Are you seeing anyone?
No.
Well, why not? Sex is an important and healthy part of life. It's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yes, I know that. Unfortunately, I'm not having any right now.
What happened to that cop? The black man?
He met someone else.
When you auditioned, did you know which brother you were auditioning for?
Yeah, I was asked to read for the part of David from the beginning, and when I read the script, I think I responded to that role. Because, of course, I had it in mind, but I think I would have anyway, just because, you know, if drama is conflict, David is inherently dramatic because he's conflicted over his sexuality, of course, but also his relationship to his family, to his work, to his religious life, even. They're all characterized by conflict.
So what did you have to do to prove yourself against the other David Fishers?
I don't know. I think in spite of the fact that on paper I suppose I'm very different from David, there was something that I did immediately respond to in terms of having a sense of how he might express himself or how he walked or breathed, or I don't know, that sense of resenting what you imagine to be a lack of appreciation for all the sacrifices you've made for all the other people in your life. And not that I'm fueled by resentment, but I guess I knew what that was about somehow, and took that as a starting point.
In 6 Feet Under, you play someone who runs a family funeral business. Had you already had the experience of going to a funeral director and organizing a funeral, choosing the coffin, making all those horrible arrangements?
I'd been sort of on the periphery of intake meetings. I was never the person who was making the decisions, but I'd been through that with family members and the like, and I'd been to wakes of friends and family members, and could draw on that, just that atmosphere. I've heard Alan talk about it. Just, it's a place where, and I think they do this in terms of the way they shoot the show, that everything's real, but there's just some sort of peppering of surreality when you're in that situation. Of course, David and Nate are on the other side of that and maybe are creating a space for people to exist in a place where they can feel whatever they need to feel. But there remains that element of surreality or timelessness. Time stops, and I remembered that.
Did you meet anybody who reminded you of yourself on the other end of the desk when you were arranging the funerals?
Well, I think my father passed away when I was 11, and I think my most intense memories of spending time in a funeral home were come from that time. And I guess we haven't had someone quite that young, but I know when Gabe Demas, who's younger six-year-old brother, shot and killed himself accidentally, was there with his mother. Of course, he felt an incredible amount of guilt and responsibility because he was looking after a kid who shot himself. But when my father died, just because of the confusing feelings that come up, I dealt with some of that sense of guilt or vague responsibility as well. So I think I did relate to that, yeah.
Well, so far this season, the good news is you don't have AIDS, although you'd been having unprotected sex. The bad news is you do have gonorrhea.
Right.
The other bad news is your ex-boyfriend appears to be in a solid relationship with a new guy, and you still have feelings for him.
Right.
When did you find out what the story for this season would be?
Well, we really find out about things on a script-to-script or episode-to-episode basis. So I wasn't presented with an arc for the new season. I was presented with the first script, and while shooting that script, about halfway through, would get a copy of the next, and so on and so on. So it's kind of like leading a second life. You have a little bit of warning, and sometimes you'll maybe want to get a sense of where things are going just so you can have that in mind. But I think one of the unique challenges of doing an episodic serial like this is that you don't rehearse it as an entire piece as you would a play, or don't shoot it with an entire arc in mind. At least when you do a movie, you have something that's very open-ended, and every script is a page turner. You know, we never know exactly what's going to come next, but that's the fun of it too.
What do people most ask you about in terms of the plot? What do people most want to know?
Early on, people were interested in who burned down the house.
Right.
But I guess usually specific questions about the show have to do with my character, because of course they're talking to me. And I've had a woman recognize me and tell me she loves the show, and then put her hand on my arm and tell me that she hopes that I'm going to be okay. This was about halfway through the first season, which was kind of exciting and creepy simultaneously. There was a guy who walked by me in the locker room of the gym in New York, an older guy, and this was after the season finale when David had had his epiphany in church, and he told me he was glad I was finally starting to behave myself. That's all he said. just said that and walked away. And you know, like a New York fireman walked up and recognized me from the show and said, "Are you going to get back together with that cop? I like you guys, you know." So, which is great.
I do too. I also think you should get back together.
Good.
Because you play a gay character.
Right.
Probably a lot of viewers wonder if you are gay or straight yourself, and how you feel about playing a gay actor, a gay character in the series.
Right. Well, you know, my first impulse is to say, well, what does it matter? But I think the fact that the character has resonance is why it matters. People inevitably have varying degrees of preoccupation with sexual orientation. I'm not gay. No one ever asked me if I'm a mortician, you know. But
we know you're not. We know
right,
you're
I'm
an actor.
Right. I'm not gay. I'm not a mortician. I'm an only child, not a middle child. So I'm, you know, it's a bit of internal alchemy and imaginative work that is why I do what I do. And I'm really honored to breathe life into the character because I recognize, as I think a lot of people do, that he's a pretty unique creation in terms of a character on television or film or really anywhere I've seen, and that he's a complex flesh and blood, you know, person who's not incidentally gay and is not the understanding neighbor upstairs or the comic relief. His relationship to his sexuality is very complicated, and I think that's unique. So I feel a sense of responsibility, and I'm honored to play the part.
Is it an issue anymore playing a gay character and how that may or may not affect future casting roles? Is that,
I don't know.
Is that just a thing of the past now, or is that something?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I think it's certainly not enough of an issue for me to not play the part. And when I read the part, I'm not playing David in spite of the fact that he's gay. I mean, because he's such a great character. He's such a great character because of his conflict, and his conflict is rooted in his relationship to his sexuality. So I guess in that sense, I'm playing the part because he's gay. I don't know. You know, if anybody out there lacks the imagination or is holding on to whatever bigotry that would keep them from wanting to work with me, I don't really want to work with them anyway, so...
Michael C. Hall speaking with Terry Gross. Hall plays David on the HBO series 6 Feet Under. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview Terry Gross recorded last year with Michael C. Hall. He plays David, the gay brother on 6 Feet Under, the HBO series about a family that runs a funeral home.
Have you been in movies?
Nope.
None at all? Not even a small part?
No, this is really my first thing other than I did couple days. I delivered some room service on an episode of All My Children in between theater jobs back in New York. But other than that, this is it. This is, they definitely took a chance because I didn't have a reel or anything when they hired me of screen work. So this is my first chance to get in front of a camera. I'm just glad that I was able to play a character who was so tense because I didn't have to try to get over it. I could just incorporate it into what I was doing and hope that as David relaxed, I as an actor would relax as well.
Do you have a favorite episode from the series so far?
Favorite
scene for yourself?
I guess some of my favorite scenes and one of my favorite episodes are in there's the Las Vegas episode, I guess the third to last episode of the first season. I think because in that episode, David's coming out to his mother and his epiphany at the church in the final episode, notwithstanding, it's one of his biggest triumphs in that he goes to Las Vegas, steps in, and gives a speech that his father was scheduled to give, and goes off the cue cards, throws them in the air, and improvises, which is something that he's not so inclined to do, and it's a triumph, and his dad's former colleagues embrace him and take him out. And then he's outed by a stripper. They turn on him, and David in turn turns on himself and acts out in the most extremely self-loathing way that he does up to that point when he solicits the prostitute in Las Vegas. So as far as David goes from the top of the mountain all the way to the bottom in that episode, and that was fun.
What did you do to prepare for it?
With a job like this, I guess I could say that was the 11th episode. So in a way, I did the first 10 episodes.
I'd played, good answer.
I'd played David for 10 hours, and I found myself very, preparing, and I was very on top of things early on, and I had a real sense of how it would all unfold, and of course would modify that as we actually shot the scenes. Towards the end, you really do have to surrender somewhat. You can't do that kind of preparation again and again and again, because in a lot of ways, all the work you've done up to that point is that preparation.
Now, you said you'd never done any movies, and right. really not any television either,
right?
Before doing 6 Feet Under, but you had done stage work.
Mm-hmm.
The transition from stage to camera can be difficult. What was that transition like for you? Because you had to learn what it's like to be in front of the camera, and you had to learn for real really quickly.
Yeah. I think I've done my share of auditioning before getting this job for television shows or small parts in movies, and I think having a character that I could so completely absorb myself with helped me to forget about the camera initially. And whereas sometimes reading for a sitcom pilot, my self-consciousness would be a larger presence than my sense of the character. And as I've gone on, I think I've realized that the camera can be your friend, and you have to sort of accept that it's very much in the room with you, and in a lot of ways a character in the scene, because it's the point of view.
How aware are you of where the camera is, what it's looking at?
It varies. You know, 6 Feet Under, we do a lot of different kinds of shots. There's a standard shot that you may notice, that there'll be someone in the foreground and someone in the background. And they'll do raking shots sometimes, two characters in profile, but they're both in focus. Sometimes during intake meetings, maybe you'll see David and Nate. One, you're almost close enough to whisper into one character's ear, and then the other one's a little bit beyond that. And when a camera's that close to you, you definitely need to keep in mind that it's there, and maybe modify modify what you're doing, or the degree to which you're doing it. And rather than pretending the camera isn't there, very much embracing the camera and where it is. And I people always talked about making love to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
I never really had a sense of what that meant until I think it's just, it's about that. It's about not shutting it out, but rather opening yourself to it. And, I think Frances Conroy, who plays the mother on the show, is an amazing example of that. She's just so sort of wide open in terms of her screen presence.
Are there things that really surprised you about how you looked on camera?
I thought I looked like an alien.
I
wasn't used to it. It's kind of like the first time you hear your tape-recorded voice, maybe.
Uh-huh.
I watched the pilot, and I thought everyone was wonderful, but there was this alien in a suit walking through the scenes. But at the same time, I tried to get over that, because I know some actors say they don't watch themselves, but I feel like there's a great deal to learn in that, and I've gotten a little bit more used to it. Inevitably, I cringe at some points, and sometimes that's about acting, sometimes it's about vanity, but...
Well, those two things can really be in conflict. If you're self-conscious, but
right.
you feel that the way to learn is to watch yourself, you know, those two impulses are a little bit at war.
Yeah. It's interesting, because the look of the show is we have different directors for almost every episode, but because the look of the show is somewhat consistent, now when we shoot shots, at least on a set that's familiar to me, I really... When I watch them afterwards, I realize that I can totally see them in my head. And so that's nice.
Now, earlier we were talking about how before you got the role of David Fisher on 6 Feet Under, you played the MC in the Broadway production of Cabaret. Have you done much singing and dancing on stage?
When I was a kid, my first experiences performing were in choirs. I was in a boys' choir, like in fifth grade, and
mm-hmm.
did a lot of choral singing through college. I was in a chamber choir that sang in Vienna, and I did a lot of that, and did high school musicals. But when I got out of college, I went to grad school at NYU and really focused strictly on acting. And I guess it wasn't until a few years out of college that I started to do some workshops of musical theater pieces in New York, and came back to the musical theater. But I think I always knew that I probably would.
What were your biggest parts in musicals when you were in school?
I went to a private day school, and so there was a big musical that I was a part of every spring from sixth grade through my senior year. So I did, see if I can remember them. The Sound of Music, The King and I, South Pacific, Bye Bye Birdie, Oklahoma, Fiddler on the Roof, and Annie Get Your Gun.
So what were the songs that were best suited to you?
Best suited to me?
Mm-hmm.
I would say my favorite performance, and it was ultimately just a chance to show off, was in ninth grade when I got to play Conrad Birdie in Bye Bye Birdie. And got to walk into the audience and spray painted my hair black. And
did you get to sing Sincere?
Got to be, yeah. You got to be sincere. And what a lot of living to do.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
Which, ironically enough, I sang the Anne Margaret verse of in the 10th episode of 6 Feet Under in the first season when I was dancing with the vacuum cleaner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael C. Hall plays David on the HBO series 6 Feet Under. The 12th episode of the first season airs on Sunday. 6 Feet Under begins taping its third season this fall. Michael C. Hall currently stars in the Broadway revival of Chicago. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the voice of God. We hear from actor James Earl Jones. He has one of the most distinctive voices in the business. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the rise and decline of the word greed. And David Edelstein reviews the new foreign film, Mostly Marta. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. What with Enron, WorldCom, and the impending baseball strike, these days the papers are full of the word greed. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg has noticed that greed's a word we only see in the papers. We don't use it much in our daily lives. He has these thoughts about the most newsworthy of the seven deadly sins.
The other day, I looked at a database of major newspapers to see how often the words greed or greedy occurred near the words corporate, CEO, or executive. Not surprisingly, the total's way up for 2002, more than seven times as great as for the same period last year. And the figure would have been still higher if I'd thrown in the phrases baseball players and team owners. What's more interesting, the word greed by itself is a lot more frequent in all contexts this year than last. It's up almost 50% since January. It's odd for a common word like that to change its frequency so rapidly, particularly when it's the name of a basic human frailty. After all, whatever people may like to think, it isn't as if the amount of greed in the world fluctuates the way the number of school shootings or bankruptcies does. But the media give a lot more attention to greed at some times than others, and particularly when the economy is tanking. When you chart the frequencies of greed and greedy in the press, they turn out to be an almost perfect trailing indicator for the stock market. The worse the Dow is doing, the more the media start talking about greediness. The words declined steadily between 1994 and 2000, then they shot up again until they returned to a near record level this summer, when all the market indices were at five-year lows. In the press, the summers of greed seem always to follow the winters of our discontent. It's remarkable that the press talks about greed as much as they do. In newspapers, the word is 50% more common than the word envy. That's very different from what you'd find if you followed ordinary people around with a tape recorder. Greed seems to be a purely public dereliction. It isn't something we talk about much in daily life. In my household, we sometimes throw the adjective greedy around, but only in a jocular way and more often in reference to pizza than to money. Don't get greedy, you already had two slices. But getting greedy is just a momentary lapse, not a moral condition. And the word greed isn't what comes to mind when I think about people I know who take an immoderate interest in accumulating money and material things. I might question their values, but I don't think of it as a sin. It's more on the line of a having disorder. Maybe this is just a matter of perspective. However you define it, greed always comes down to wanting more than your fair share. And at the scale of everyday life, it's easier to see what counts as more than a fair share of a pizza than more than a fair share of money. In fact, I'll bet most people would have a hard time thinking of themselves as greedy under any circumstances, given that the notion of a fair share is wonderfully elastic. I'm confident that if somebody offered me an eight-figure compensation package, I'd find a way to convince myself that I deserved every penny. If it didn't have a public career to sustain it, greed would probably sound as quaint and biblical as words like sloth and wrath and gluttony do. But the fact that we don't think about greed in everyday settings is exactly what makes it a useful notion to keep around in public life. It's so remote that we can all denounce it with a clear conscience. People tend to talk about greed as a collective pathology rather than as an individual vice. In the press, I'm always running into references to corporate greed and investor greed, greedy developers, and greedy oil companies. But writers rarely use greed and greedy to describe particular people, apart from rapacious movie villains and a couple of poster child miscreants who have actually been caught dead to rights. And even then, there's a striking discrepancy. Enron is 25 times more likely to be described as greedy than Kenneth Lay is. The curious thing about all this isn't that it makes greed easy to condemn, but that it also makes it easy to defend. That's what explains the success of the slogan, "Greed is good." That phrase was originally supposed to evoke the audience's repugnance when Michael Douglas uttered it in the movie Wall Street. But the champions of the market system have adopted it as a defiant way of praising untrammeled acquisitiveness as the source of economic growth and all the good things it brings with it. You can still find people saying this even after the revelations of the last year or so, though a certain defensiveness has crept into their tone. There's nothing new about this notion. 200 years ago, David Hume called avarice the spur of industry. It's hard to imagine anybody making a catchphrase like that out of most of the other deadly sins. Gluttony is groovy. Sloth is splendid. But then greed is a more conveniently removed vice than the others. You can praise it in the abstract without expecting that anybody's actually going to own up to it. Jack Welch isn't about to claim in his autobiography that he owes his success to his overweening greed. For that matter, the guy in the TV repair shop doesn't crow about the social benefits of greed when he's explaining why he's charging you $75 to make an estimate. However people try to redeem it, there's no sin that's privately more shameful and unlovable than greed is. It's what the poet Matthew Green called the sphincter of the heart.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, we hear the voice of authority, James Earl Jones. This is Fresh Air. James Earl Jones has a voice that conveys power and authority. He was the voice of Darth Vader in Star Wars. He's the voice of Verizon and CNN. So it's surprising to read in his memoir about all the trouble his voice has caused him. Terry spoke with James Earl Jones in 1993 when his memoir Voices and Silences first came out. A new edition has just been published. In it, Jones writes about his personal life and his career on stage in such plays as The Blood Knot, The Great White Hope, Othello, and Fences, in films such as Field of Dreams, Coming to America, and Summersby, and on TV, including his own series, Gabriel's Fire. Jones grew up in rural Mississippi. His family moved to Michigan when he was still a boy. In retrospect, he credits this uprooting with causing his stutter. As a child, the stutter was very bad. In fact, there was a period between the ages of 6 and 14 when he barely spoke at all.
I did the basics. I was able to function as a farm kid, doing all those chores where you call animals. I think I had my best conversations with the dog, who was a good friend of mine and didn't challenge me in any way. I certainly let the family know what my needs were. But when strangers came to the house, the mute happened. I didn't want to confront them, and I wasn't ready. I hid in the state of muteness.
Did you not want to speak, or did you feel physically unable to speak?
It was just too embarrassing.
Because of the stutter?
And too difficult, yeah.
Well, what were some of the things that adults or friends did to try to coax you to talk more?
No, they left me alone. My family had a habit of letting me have my way a lot when it came to sometimes major life decisions. But when it was about me, they let me decide. And that was one of them, when I wanted to leave the church, leave Sunday school, leave the religion because of the stuttering and because of the kids laughing. They accepted that. You know.
Even though your grandmother was very religious.
Oh, boy, was she ever. She's... Yeah, she was a triple born again.
Can you tell us the story of how you started speaking again?
Donald Crouch was an associate of...
Donald Crouch was your teacher?
Yeah, Robert Frost. He was a college professor, but he ended up in this high school because he retired. He was a Mennonite farmer, and he retired to his farm in Brethren, Michigan. And the idea that there were kids down the road at this high school who were studying Chaucer and Shakespeare and stuff... He couldn't stand it, so he came back and taught high school, you know. He was the first English teacher I had. Now, see, I'm stuttering again. He was the first English teacher I had. And he accepted that I wasn't verbal, that I wasn't oral. But he didn't like the idea that I could privately, subjectively enjoy poetry and not sound it out loud. He one day discovered that I wrote poetry, and he said to me, this poem is so good, I don't think you really wrote it. I think you plagiarized it, which was a shock to me. And I could admit that it was Longfellow-esque, but it was not certainly stolen from Longfellow. And he said, the way you can prove it to me that you wrote it was to get up in front of the class and recite it by heart. And I accepted the challenge and did it, and we both... realized then we had a means, we had a way of regaining the power of speech through reading poetry.
Mm-hmm. So how does the stutter come back very much for you?
You've heard it several times mm-hmm. now. It's always with me, you know. And I have to be careful not to talk too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly becomes a problem whenever I do something emotional, whether in real life or as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I hit an emotional speech, whether it's a positive emotion or a negative,
yeah.
joy or pain. And that often leads to overload, and I have to be very careful. There was a time when my acting was affected by it. I think Gladys Vaughn was the first to notice it. She says, when you get emotional, when you Othello, for instance, gets emotional, I sometimes believe you less. And it's because I'm being too careful. You can't measure out emotion. It has a flow.
Has your Othello ever stuttered?
No, none of my characters have ever stuttered except for the very first thing I did on Broadway. I played the role of Edward, FDR's houseboy, valet, as a young man. I had the line, Mrs. Roosevelt, supper is served. And I got hung on the mama word.
Yeah.
And it is funny, isn't it? But it gets so ridiculous. Mary Thicket, who was playing Eleanor Roosevelt, was very patient. She just stood there and let me get through it. She knew, the audience knew that something was wrong, but she didn't want to embarrass me any further by saying my line for me.
Right.
So she let me have my moment. I got through it, and it's never happened since.
What was it like in your early days as an actor, before you had the reputation, before you were James Earl Jones? And you'd go and talk to a casting director, and you'd be stuttering when talking to them, and then you'd have to somehow convince them that on stage you were going to be fine. I mean, casting directors, I'm sure, are pretty insecure about that kind of thing.
No, there was never a problem. I don't know why, but it never was. Marlon Brando and all the method actors had made stuttering a part of the way Americans talk.
Oh, a part of, like, emotional truth that you're grasping so hard for truth. I think some of the advice that your voice teacher gave you was to not use the full power of your voice, just to save some of it in reserve.
Well, that's just good acting. Once you take your character to the limit, the mm-hmm. the audience can tell that he has no more. There's nothing in reserve, and they get less interested. There's less suspense about what you're going to do next, you know?
So do you know where your limit is and how to go just short of that?
I just got off the set of a show we did in Richmond, Virginia. And the very last day, I remember yelling at the director for the first time. I wanted to yell at him a lot, but I was rehearsing a scene with Mary Alice, in which...
I like her a lot.
Yeah, me too. And I felt lucky that she was able to join that cast and playing my wife again, playing Mrs. Altona Johns to my Vernon Johns. And she was going up the stairs, having admitted that she just allowed our oldest daughter to get on a segregated bus. And in my outrage, I flip out about it. Well, in my rehearsal, I flipped out to the peak of my voice, and the director was about to say, I don't think it should be that loud. I said, shut up, leave me alone, let us find our way. You know, and I was very rude to him. But he was about to remind me that you can't do it at the peak. You got to leave something in reserve, and I knew that. But sometimes I have to test the walls myself, test the you know, what the space can hold myself, you know, and not go on a theory.
So when you were yelling at the director, were you using the full power?
Yeah. I tested the limits of the set with him too. Yeah.
Now, your father was an actor. He was a boxer first, then he became an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like your family wasn't really proud of that. I mean, you were raised by your grandparents. They didn't seem at all proud.
They would have been proud. They became later proud of Joe Louis. I think my grandfather was secretly proud of Jack Johnson mm-hmm. as he was of Satchel Paige, the baseball player.
What about the acting part of his career? It sounds like you're...
What I'm getting at is they just didn't understand it.
Right.
It was hard enough for them to understand a prize fighter
right.
making a real honest living.
Yeah.
Much less a troubadour actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just not within the comprehension. These are people who we got our life from the soil. And I'm very proud of that. That I shared that kind of life with them, But they had no way of understanding Robert Earl.
Right.
And were very intolerant of him, and very resistant to my ever meeting him. I didn't get to meet him until I was 21, until I was legal age. And my mother was a part of that too. It was a very bad marriage, and which I tried to explain in the book and tried to show both sides.
I guess that's part of the reason why you ended up being brought up by your grandparents.
Oh, that was the reason. My mother wanted to be a single mother. But my grandmother knew better, that during the Depression it was hard enough for her, a 20-year-old girl, to manage her own life, and she insisted that she found a way to adopt me.
In your memoir, Voices and Silences, you devote a total of about a paragraph to Star Wars, to your voice as Darth Vader, and I got the impression that. It's not something you really want to call that much attention to.
Are you kidding? Not true. It's just that I have very little to talk about.
Okay.
Had I been one of the actors and given points, I would not only be wealthy, I'd be probably much better known.
You got a flat fee?
Oh, yeah. I think George Lucas, first of all, realized that although David Prowse was the actor he wanted, it was not the sound he wanted. So he searched around for a technically and in symbolically a darker voice.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually came to me and said to Lucy, would Jenny like to earn a day's salary? The job took 2.5 hours. They paid me all of $9,000, which was not bad for 2.5 hours of work.
Right.
None of us knew what we had.
Right.
And that was fine. Almost not out of embarrassment, but out of his traditionally, his non-traditional capitalism, or lack of capitalism, George gave me a Christmas bonus that amounted to the same amount of money. But I was just acting as special effects. That's all that was.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was having done the Great White Hope film. I'd become a member of the board of directors of the Oscar board, Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, at a time when the controversy over whether Mercedes McCambridge deserved credit for her contributions to the Linda Blair's voice, the devil coming
in The Exorcist.
Yeah, The Exorcist. And I thought there was a silly argument that I said to myself that all the Mercedes is special effects. And I wanted to keep that clear in my case, so I didn't even take credit for the voice of Darth Vader.
Forgive me, I know this is a small part of your career, but I have to ask you about the CNN voice. The first time someone said to me, I think that's James Earl Jones, I said, nah. There's no way they're right. Why did you decide to take that on when you were offered it?
You asked me what is the Star Wars involvement meant to me. What it did, it made my voice viable in the commercial world. But I don't know why. I avoided that. Great way to make a living and great craft unto itself. But the Star Wars sort of put my name on the A list, as they say out there, for authoritative voices.
So your attitude was, why not take advantage of it?
My attitude?
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, why kick something that's going to sit on your lap out of the house? I mean, I think the first commercials I did, one for Chrysler and one for Goodyear and one for Fisher products, audio products. And they asked me to just give us the sound of God. Goodyear Vector tires, let God sell Goodyear Vector tires.
No problem.
They had no. They were not embarrassed about saying that.
So, do you have a voice of yours that you think of the voice of God?
No. It's just that the sound is let it go as bass as it can go and still be clear.
Yeah.
And to sound like I mean it. And there's not a product I've ever promoted that I don't use, including Wells Lamont gloves, working man's gloves.
And of course, the Yellow Pages.
And Ruben's dinners out in Ruben's chain of restaurants. Orson Welles and Vincent Price and I were once asked to simply, on a recording, read the menu. with as much slobbering, lustful sounds as we can conjure. And we got paid for it.
Well, James Earl Jones, I thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you immensely.
Thank you.
James Earl Jones, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. His memoir, Voices and Silences, is out in a new paperback edition. Coming up, a review of the new film, Mostly Marta. This is Fresh Air. Mostly Marta is a German romantic comedy that's slowly opening around the country. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It's a funny thing. The most wonderful romantic comedies, I mean The Shop Around the Corner or This Summer's About a Boy, feature people nearly paralyzed by melancholy. Desperately lonely people who could easily end up by themselves or even dead. People for whom a happy ending is the gift of a puckish god. Which brings us to a new German comedy called Mostly Marta. It doesn't have many laughs, but it leaves you laughing, the way people laugh when they're teetering over the abyss, but they somehow manage not to take the plunge. I love it when I giggle through my tears. The heroine is Marta Klein, played by Martina Geddick. She's a chef who lives for her cooking, which is her art, and that's all she lives for, which makes her a little brittle. She's sent by the owner of her restaurant to see a psychiatrist, but all she wants to talk about is food. She confounds her shrink by cooking for him. Marta works in a high-end Italian restaurant, but the atmosphere, that's high Teutonic. The kitchen is immaculate. The dishes are a miracle of logistics. When someone sends a dish back, she's the opposite of gracious. She calls the customer a swine. She vows never to cook for them again. Then two things invade her neurotically sealed universe. Marta's sister and her 8-year-old daughter Lena have an auto accident, and her sister is killed. There's no one else to take custody of Lena, whose father lives in Italy and doesn't know she exists. Marta doesn't know her way around kids. She can only reach out to Lena by cooking, but the little girl is numb with grief and won't eat a thing. Her clothes get baggier, her eyes more hollow. Watching an 8-year-old starve is not exactly surefire comic material. But Marta goes back to work to find a new sous chef named Mario, an Italian who livens up the kitchen by blasting volare and tossing big bowls of pasta. She thinks he's a lunatic. He thinks she's a nutcase who can't possibly give a child a real home. You see where this is leading. No, he's not the girl's real father, but he might as well be. Lena likes Mario. She likes his friendly, inclusive way with pasta, and she likes the communal kitchen family. And so, in spite of herself, does Marta. Now, I frankly thought I'd be better defended against a movie about an uptight professional woman who gets warmed up by a moppet and a manly Italian who warbles volare. But Marta's great at what she does. She isn't meant to stand for a professional woman, but for an artist who uses her talent to keep other people at arm's length. There's another reason the movie is irresistible. If an American studio had made Mostly Marta, it would have lighting like honey and a bathtub full of violins. It would be all wet. But those Germans are quick with the dehumidifier. The writer and director, Sandra Nettelbeck, has set the movie in a wintry Hamburg. The framing is unforced, not Stanley Kubrick cold, but not in your face. The pacing is unhurried. Music doesn't underline the emotional breakthroughs. The movie has German reserve and Italian extroversion in just the right balance. It's on a magical border, and I don't mean Switzerland. Most of all, the movie speaks to one's helplessness around children, a theme that's both funny and sobering. As Lena, Maxine Force does an exquisite job of staying inside herself. You never catch her acting, yet she moves from near catatonia to sheer little girlishness and back in ways that break your heart. And Martina Geddick as Marta can look as if she's 50 fathoms deep inside herself, too. She has a tremulousness that comes from being wound too tight. It's very alluring, but it also makes you nervous for the child. It's Marta's privilege when she's single to defend her personality disorders in the name of her art. But you have to be emotionally available to kids, or you risk driving them underground. And anyway, a great chef doesn't have to be anal retentive. Just look at that romantic teddy bear Mario. Okay, he's too good to be true. But the actor, Sergio Castellitto, gives him a touch of sadness that grounds him and makes you think there's more to his story than you'll ever know. He blindfolds Marta and feeds her soup and asks her to identify what's in it. And Marta, the control freak, who needs to cook for people but has never liked anyone cooking for her, begins to relax and open up. Mostly Marta isn't a foodie movie like Tampopo and Babette's Feast and Big Night. It shows how food can be a barrier as well as a bridge. But it makes you hungry for contact, for the nourishment of romantic comedy in a cold and love-starved world.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate.
Volare, oh, cantare, oh, let's fly way up to the clouds.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Volare, oh, e cantare, oh, no wonder my happy heart sings, your love has given me wings. Penso che io sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipinge con le mani e la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso tenido dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito. Volare, oh, oh.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Lindley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin our 60s Music Week. We hear from songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, singers Bobby V and Leslie Gore. Join us for the next Fresh Air. But when